to gather. Along the top of the soot-darkened wall of the parking area, barbed wire lay coiled, as though even the littered and unlovely motel lot posed such threat, or value, that it was immediately at war with the rest of the world. For Charlie, this seemed to prove the futility of the dreams presented in the department store windows he had walked by earlier. In this town, they had found together, half an hour outside of Peoria. You could buy a snowblower or a nice wool dress for your wife. But beneath it all, people were rats, scurrying off to find garbage to eat, another rat to hump, making a nest in broken bricks and soiling it so sourly that one's contribution to the world was only more excrement. But there to the left was the top of a maple tree, the branches holding forth two pinkly yellow leaves with apologetic gentleness. And how had they held on until November? Right behind it was the last of the day's full light. Generously, the colors from the setting sun sprayed upward over the open sky. Charlie put his large hand to the side of his face, remembering, why should this come to him now? Crouching on a small hillside, planting crocus bulbs with Marilyn in the same kind of autumn light. It had been their freshman year at the university. He remembered her eagerness, her eyes large with intent. He had known nothing about planting crocus bulbs, and these, she told him, short-breathed with excitement, would be her first. They had bought a trowel in town that afternoon and walked up the small hill behind her dormitory to a patch of autumn grass next to the college woods. "Okay, here," she said, really anxious. He had seen how serious this was for her, planting her first flowers at the age of 18, with him, her first love. He had been moved by her eagerness, bundled up as she was in her long woolen coat. They dug the holes, put the bulbs in. "Bye-bye, good luck," she had said to one bulb. The very stuff that would make him roll his eyes now. Her utter foolishness. The useless, nauseating softness that lay at the center of her had thrilled him quietly that day with a rush of love and protectiveness as the autumn smell of earth filled him, kneeling there with the trowel. Dear befuddled Marilyn, her face flushed with the excitement of the job done. "Do you think they'll come up?" she had asked worriedly. The poor thing. Always worried. He said they would. And they did. A few did. But he could not remember that part as well. He could only really remember what he had long forgotten until right now. A day of innocence in autumn, when they were just kids. Charlie closed the window blinds. The blinds were plastic slats, dirty with age, and they clicked into place unevenly as he tugged on the cord. Panic, like a large minnow darting upstream, moved back and forth inside him. He was suddenly as homesick as a child sent to stay with relatives. When the furniture seemed large and dark and strange, and the smell peculiar, each detail assaultive with a differentness that was almost unbearable. "I want to go home," he thought. And the desire seemed to squeeze the breath from him, because it was not his home in Carlisle, Illinois, where he lived with Marilyn, that he wanted to go home to. His grandchildren right down the street. And it was not his childhood home either, which was in Carlisle as well. Nor was it their first home as newlyweds outside of Madison. He did not know what home it was he longed for. But it seemed to him as he aged that his homesickness would increase, and because he could not tolerate the Marilyn he now lived with, a woman who nevertheless filled his estranged, expatriated heart with pity, he did not know what he would do. And the minnow darting through the stream of his anxiety landed briefly on his current Carlisle home with his grandchildren down the street, swam to the golf course where he did still sometimes enjoy the expanse of green before him, swam to the woman who might or might not show up here with her head of dark glossy hair. And not one place seemed stable. A soft knock came on his motel door. "Hello, Charlie." She smiled, her eyes warm, as she walked past him into the room. He knew instantly. His instincts had been honed in youth, and this ability had never left him, the one to detect disaster. Still, a man needed his dignity. So he nodded and said, "Tracy." She walked farther into the room, and when he saw that she had brought her overnight bag, and why would she not have, really? He was pathetically and fleetingly gladdened. But then she sat on the bed and smiled at him again. And he knew again. "Take your coat?" he asked. She shrugged her way out of it. "Charlie," she said. He watched himself. A little bit. It was fascinating. He was an organism about to be dealt a blow, and he used his natural powers to defend himself. This meant that he observed carefully the pitted parts of her upper cheeks, the pores that were jagged shapes indicating an adolescence he already knew had been hard. He noted the scent on the coat that he held, how even in its faintness it was cloying and unsubtle. And he hung the piece of clothing on the back of the desk chair rather than in the closet next to his own. He observed the way her eyes would not look at him directly, and he thought that he hated dishonesty, or lack of courage, more than anything. He moved as far away from her as the small room would allow, so that he stood leaning against the wall opposite. Now she looked at him, with a sardonic, apologetic expression. "I need money," she said. And she sighed deeply, putting her hand on the bedspread. The fingers each had a ring, including her thumb. And it was still surprising to him how his mind was trying to remind him, "Charlie, for God's sake, take note." How repulsive so many parts of her should be to him, and yet were not. The crap of class superiority would protect no man for long. Many lived whole lives and never knew this. Charlie did. "Just tell me," he said.
10.
He stayed exactly where he was. On the small table next to the bed, his cell phone suddenly vibrated. Tracy leaned to look.
"Your wife," she said.
"Just reporting." Indifferent. Charlie walked to the phone and slipped it into his pocket, where it shuddered in his palm a few moments before stopping. He said to Tracy, who remained sitting on the bed,
"I can't, sweetheart."
"But you can."
Clearly, she had not expected this, and that was a surprise to him.
"No, I can't."
"You have plenty of money, Charlie."
"I have a wife and children and grandchildren is what I have."
He had bought champagne because she liked it. And he watched as she noticed it now on the bureau top in the plastic motel bucket he'd filled with ice. She looked back at him ruefully.
You break my heart, she said. Of all,
he laughed, a bark of a sound. Of all your Johns, I break your heart the most.
But it's true.
She stood and walked to the champagne.
And don't be crass, Charlie. I have clients, and you're not one of them.
I know you have clients, he said.
John's is so yesterday, for Christ's sake, Charlie.
Forget it.
No, I'm not forgetting it.
Tracy, stop. You and I, right now, are about to act out one of the oldest stories in the book. And I don't care to. I know all the lines. I know all the background music. I don't want, he opened his palm, to do it. That's all. And I won't.
The pain that moved briefly across her face gratified him. He had always felt she loved him, as he did her. But there was suddenly a refreshing simplicity that seemed to move into the room, an unexpected and huge relief, a straightening out of things. Go home and get your things in order, a doctor would say.
No, affairs. Go home and get your affairs in order.
That clarification, he couldn't help it, struck Charlie as funny. He was, in the tiniest way, delighted, as though all those people whose lives had occurred long before he'd been born had known these things, phrases used for years. Go home and get your affairs in order. Inside his pocket, his phone vibrated again, and he brought it out to see. Marilyn was printed in blue across the screen.
Want me to step out?
The question was intimate, because it had been asked so many times in the past. The tone was conversational, familiar. He nodded. She slipped her coat back on, and he gave her a room key. He said,
They have that tiny lobby.
But she said her car was fine. She'd listen to the radio. Really, it was no problem. She had always been pretty wonderful that way.
It was her job to be wonderful that way.
But even after the day she'd told him her real name, sitting fully dressed in the chair by the desk, I want to tell you my real name, and brought out her driver's license to prove it. She was still wonderful that way. After the day she showed him her license, she'd insisted that he not offer her money again. Perhaps she'd been mulling this over, and now figured she was owed. Perhaps she was. The door closed quietly behind her. He resisted the urge to look through the blind slats and watch her get into her car. The peculiar hopefulness had not left him, the pleasing understanding that the situation would be over soon was essentially over already. And it felt quite survivable, which he had somehow not known. His wife was crying on the phone.
Charlie, oh, I'm sorry to bother you. Really, I am. You're supposed to be having fun.
Well, I know it's not fun, but I mean, I know it's your time, and...
What's happened?
He felt no alarm.
Oh, Charlie. She was mean to me again. I called, you know, to see if the girls were all set with their Thanksgiving dresses. And Janet said, she said, Marilyn, I'm asking you. No, I'm telling you, I'm just going to come right out and tell you, Marilyn, that you call here too much. This is my house, and Stevie is my husband, and we need some space. That's what she said, Charlie.
And Stevie, who even knows if he was home? Does he have any spine, our son?
Charlie stopped listening. He was absolutely and silently on the side of his children, and on the side of his son's wife. He sat down on the bed.
Charlie,
she said. I'm here. Inadvertently, he glanced at himself in the mirror. He had long ago stopped looking like anyone familiar. In a few minutes, he had calmed his wife enough to hang up. She'd apologized once more for disturbing him and said he had made her feel better. He'd answered, "Okay then, Marilyn." Alone in the room, with silence, he understood the previous hiatus, which had now returned to him, that spaciousness of calm. Long ago, he'd assigned a private name to it, the hit-thumb theory. On his grandfather's roof as a child one summer, hammering tiles down hard, he discovered that if you hammered your thumb by mistake, there was a split second when you thought, hey, this isn't so bad, considering how hard I was hit. And then, after that moment of false, bewildered, and grateful relief, came the crash and crush of real pain. In the war, this had happened so often, in so many forms, he'd sometimes thought he was brilliant. The analogy was that apt. In the war, he had learned many things. And not one of them had he heard any psychologist mention during any of the meetings that Marilyn now thought he was attending. Charlie stood up. He felt the itch of desire that was carnal, corporeal. It included much and was not a stranger to him. Arms crossed, he walked back and forth in front of the queen-size bed, with its spread that was made of fibers, he knew from having felt it many times, meant to endure all things. Back and forth he walked, back and forth. He had sometimes walked back and forth for hours. A warmth of emotion came to him. He had not, at the time of its construction, been interested in the memorial. No, Charlie McCauley had not been interested a bit. And yet one day, after many nights of being bombarded repeatedly with the memories of Kaysan, he took a bus by himself all the way to Washington, and what a thing he found there. He had wept without sound or self-consciousness, walking along the dark granite wall, seeing names he recalled, touching them with his coarsened fingertips. And people nearby, he could sense them, tourists, most likely. Left him alone with respect. This he could feel, that they were respecting him as he wept. He had never thought such a thing possible. Back in Carlisle, he told Marilyn, "It was good I went." She surprised him by saying only, "I'm glad, Charlie." And then later that night, she said, "Listen, you go back whenever you need to. I mean it. We have enough money for you to make that trip any time you need it. People could surprise you. Not just their kindness, but also their sudden ability to express things the right way." He felt he never expressed anything the right way. Once he had been in a department store with his son and daughter-in-law. Janet had needed a sweatshirt. Charlie had just been following along, not interested one way or another. But his son was interested, and when Charlie glanced over, suddenly paying attention, he saw his son talking thoughtfully and earnestly to his wife. Janet was a plain and pleasant woman. And it was the glimpse of this, the engagement of his son in this small domestic exchange, that almost brought Charlie to his knees. What a son! What a man he was, this grown boy who would stand so decently and discuss with his wife exactly what sweatshirt she desired in a store that smelled like a circus tent of cheap candy and peanuts and who knows what. His son caught his eye. His face opened. "Hey, Dad, how you doing there? Ready to go?" The word arrived. Clean. His son was clean.
"I'm good," Charlie said, raising a hand slightly. "Take your time."
And because he was Charlie, who years ago had fouled himself profoundly, because he was Charlie and not someone else, he could not say to his son, "You are decent and strong, and none of this has anything to do with me. But you came through it, that childhood that wasn't all roses. And I'm proud of you. I'm amazed by you." Charlie could not even say a watered-down version of whatever that feeling would be. He could not even clap his son on the shoulder in greeting or when saying goodbye. At the open door of the motel room, he stood gazing at the parking lot so she would know to return. And as she walked from the car toward him, he was aware that she was aware of being watched. Except he wasn't really watching her, because the smell of autumn had accosted him, the sudden chill, and that earthy, loamy fragrance came over him with something akin to excitement. "Careful," he thought. "Careful." He stepped back to let her enter. Tracy did not remove her coat this time, and she sat in the chair by the desk instead of on the bed. He saw in her face that she had been preparing.
"Please, Charlie. Now please, just trust me. I need the money."
"I know you need it."
"Then, please."
Perhaps, perversely, he was waiting to see if she would say he owed it to her. And then, for the first time since he'd known her, he saw her eyes fill with water.
"Ah, Tracy, tell me. Come on, babe. What is it?"
"My son."
Both very slowly and immediately, this is how Charlie experienced it, he understood. Her son was in trouble with drugs. Owed a man $10,000. This knowledge entered the room like a large dark bird, its wingspan wide and frightening. He asked her directly. She nodded, the tears coming down her cheeks then, coming, coming. He was oddly fascinated, having never seen her weep before, by the large tracks of mascara dripping onto her clothes, onto the turquoise-colored nylon blouse, the skirt of black, even her boots. His wife had never worn any makeup at all.
"Ah, Tracy, kid, hey, sweetheart."
He opened one arm to her and believed he saw her desire to move to him, and maybe she would have. But he said,
"Tracy, you're in danger yourself if you do this."
Something about that seemed to offend her deeply, and she shook her head and made fists with her many ringed hands.
"What the fuck do you know? You think you know shit? Well, excuse fucking me, you don't know shit."
In this way, she helped him.
"I can't do it," he said easily. "I can't withdraw $10,000 from a bank account just like that. and not have Marilyn know. And I'm not going to, anyway.
Then her green eyes became like dark nostrils that flared. That is the image that came to him as he watched her. Her eyes moving like the nostrils of a horse, pulled up, pulled back.
My son's going to be dead if I can't come up with this money.
No tears now. Her breath came in little bursts. Very slowly, Charlie seated himself on the edge of the bed, facing her. Finally, quietly, he said,
"You understand, I had no idea you had a son."
"Well, of course, I didn't tell you."
"But why not?"
His question was genuine, puzzled.
"Let's see."
She put a ringed finger to her chin in an exaggerated form of contemplation.
"Because maybe if I explained the situation, you'd think less of me?"
"Tracy, lots of people have kids in trouble."
Her sarcasm bothered him. It seemed a knife abrading his arm.
"I'd think less of you?" he echoed.
"Ha! That's right. How could you possibly think less of..."
"Stop it. God damn it. Stop it now. Stop it."
He stood up. She said quietly,
"And you stop with the liberal white pity."
"Just in time." But in time, always Charlie was just in time.
He prevented himself from the slap across her face he could practically feel tingling throughout his hand. She turned from him with disdain, and so he did not apologize. Disdain did not become her. There was an element of theatricality to it, he felt. There had been a chaplain. God, what a nice guy he was. Simple.
"God weeps with us," he had said, and you couldn't get mad at him for that.
After the night at Quezon, they'd brought in another chaplain. A phony. Theatrical.
"Jesus is your friend," the new chaplain would say, with silly pontification, as though he were dispensing Jesus pills that only he was in charge of.
Once he had gone to the hospital, and they had asked him to come back to attend a group. It was helpful, they suggested, to hear what others had to say. But it had included, it made Charlie's head heavy to picture it, the circle of folding chairs, the younger ones in their fatigues, and it was mostly the younger ones who were there. They told of going into Iraqi towns. They told of not sleeping. They told of drinking too much. And Charlie could not stand them. Some were still young enough to have pimples. He had given orders to kids this young, and they made him sick to see. That horrified him, that he loathed these people. Being there with them exacerbated the very thing he thought he might die from. Because he could tell, and he had feared this, that the fellow running the group did not really know what to do. Because there was nothing to do. Talk about it. Sure thing. Take a cigarette break. Talk about it more. At the third meeting, he left when they broke for cigarettes, and then he was truly frightened. Robin he met through her ad on the internet. He drove the 2 hours from Carlisle to Peoria and first greeted her in the lobby of the town's oldest hotel. The hotel had recently been refurbished, and the lobby sparkled with glass and waterfalls. The elevators pinged politely off to the right as he and Robin sat in the downstairs bar. They talked quietly. And he was, oh God Almighty, he was the closest thing to happy he had been for years. A light-skinned black woman with green eyes, she gave off a sense of quiet self-assuredness. The lambency of this lightly worn authority made him right away love the space between her two front teeth, the coal pencil line above her eyelashes, how she'd listen and nod and say, "That's right." She was 40 years old, and she had two daughters who stayed with their grandmother when Robin could not be with them. He had taken a room on the top floor with a view of the river, and he noticed she discreetly kept an eye on her time, told him when he had gone over, added an hour. But she was smooth and calm and polite, and this quality remained even beneath the sweet outbursts of her sexuality, which, from the start, he had never felt to be faked, and so he was always able to feel okay. It was something.
"Why are you doing this?" he asked. "They must all wonder," he added.
"Some do, most don't. For money," she said, sitting up, shrugging slightly. "That simple." The bumps of her spine lined up perfectly beneath her skin and took his breath away. It was her suggestion a few months later that they meet at the motel, a half hour from Peoria, that the money saved from not being in the fancy hotel could be used for them to see each other more. Only he couldn't see her more than he already was. He couldn't get away. So they had continued at the motel, and he gave her the extra money. And then they fell in love. He had loved her, really, from the start. And she said she had fallen in love with him, too, and told him her name was Tracy, while she sat fully clothed right in that chair. And that was how it had been for 7 months now, desperately in love. Charlie did not like desperate. Tracy was standing in the bathroom, snapping tissues from the slit in the wall. From where Charlie sat on the bed, he could see her yanking the stiff little skirts of white. The motel made sure you could not steal a box of them. She wiped her face, then washed it with a face cloth, reapplied lipstick, and returned to the room. His relief returned as well. It had never gone far. This was going to be over, and that was all that mattered. And then, Tracy, "Boy, how people could surprise you," said something insanely funny. She said, "I thought you had the character to help me out." He asked her to repeat it, and she did, looking slightly wary. He sat down on the bed and laughed and laughed. It was not a pleasant sound, and soon he was able to stop. "I miss it," he said finally, wiping his sleeve across his face. She looked at him now with a faint sense of irritation.
"Character," he added. "I miss it."
Those days seemed like ancient times, back when character was thought to mean everything, as though character were the altar before which all decency bowed. That science now showed genetics to be determinative just threw all that character stuff right over the waterfall. That anxiety was wired, or became wired after events of trauma. That one was not strong or weak, only made a certain way. Yes, he missed character, the nobility of it. Why, it was like being forced to give up religion once you'd been confronted with its base and primitive aspects, like having to view the Catholic Church with its nest of pedophilia and endless cover-ups and popes that worked with Hitler or Mussolini? Charlie was not Catholic, and the few Catholics he knew did continue to go to Mass. But he could not see how, faced as they were with the chipping away of the brilliant facade. Of course the church was failing. But so was the Protestant concept of hard work and decency and character. Character. Who ever used that word anymore? Tracy did. Tracy used that word. He looked over at her, the eyes still smudged black with that mascara.
"Hey, kid," he said. "Hey, Tracy,"
and opened his arms to her. Quietly, she said, "My name isn't Tracy." After a moment, she added, "And that license is fake, just so you know. The whole thing is fake." She leaned forward and whispered, "Fake." A sound came from him. It was not unusual. He often made sounds without planning to. It happened sometimes in public, and it scared people. In a library once, a young person had looked at him, and Charlie understood that he had made a noise, a growl. Marilyn, idiot woman, whispered to the boy, "He was in the war." And the kid didn't know what Marilyn meant. Many young people did not know the name of the war he had served in. Was it because it was a conflict instead of a war? Was it because the country, in its shame, had pushed this war behind it like a child who in public was still being obstreperous, embarrassing? Or was it just the way that history went? He did not know. But when he heard a young person, with those perfect teeth they all had now, say, "Wait, what was that? I'm sorry," followed by the self-deprecating grimace that was utterly false in its apology, trying to gauge how old Charlie was. "Sorry, was that in the first Iraq?" Then Charlie wanted to cry. He wanted to bawl. He wanted to bellow, "We did that! And for what? For what? For what?" He had never rid himself of an abiding dislike for all Asians, and women who looked at him with fear.
"Here's an idea." Charlie stood up. "Let's go."
She hoisted her bag over her shoulder and waited. She did not look at him with fear. She did not look at him at all. The hangers in the closet twanged against one another as he got his coat. Metal hangers whose tops wrapped completely around the pole so they could not be stolen. "All set?" he asked in a cheerful voice, slipping on his coat, and he stood back to let her go through the door before him. There was the same familiar oddness of watching himself. The bewilderment of how much he loved her. Yet that was more knowledge now than feeling. When not on any conceivable level did it make sense, except for the only one that mattered. She had saved him, given him the space within which he could breathe. Or he had, through her, given this to himself, because watching her he saw nothing, not one thing, that could have caused him to feel as he did. Still desiring her, he found the sight of her puzzling. But it was over. Praise God. There was still that open space of relief.
"Follow me in your car," he said.
He headed back toward the center of this town, about which he knew almost nothing, except for his forays to this motel. He knew the department store on Main Street, and the Victorian-looking bed and breakfast that always had a vacancy sign out front,
yet always looked welcoming, wearing its fresh color of pale blue, like a shy child who had kindness within. He did not know where a branch of his bank might be, but he drove as though it would appear, only glancing once in the rearview mirror to see her following him. She was biting on her lip, a gesture so familiar to him, he knew not to look in the mirror again. He drove with the fully set sun off to his right, and he noted once more that he felt okay. Passing an old church, he thought that if she had not been following, he might have pulled over just to look at it from the road. He had sometimes felt a need to pray. This need was as abhorrent to him as was the sight of his wife. He had been brought up in a Methodist church that had done nothing for him at all, except that he associated the experience with car sickness. He had attended some services at the Congregational Church with Marilyn because she wanted to, but that experience of duty had attenuated as soon as the children reached early adolescence. He could not stand it, he told her, and she did not argue with him. They simply stopped going, and no one in the church pursued them. Except for the baptism of his grandchildren and the funeral of Patty Nicely's husband, Charlie had not been in a church for years. But these days, sometimes, he just wanted to go into a church and pray. He wanted to fall on his knees. And what would he pray for? Forgiveness. There was nothing else to pray for, not if you were Charlie McCauley. Charles McCauley did not have the luxury, the foolery, to pray for health for his children or the ability to better love his wife. No, 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 no. Charlie McCauley could only pray, beg on his knees, "Dear God, forgive me, if you can stand to." But how sickening. It made him sick. Off to the right, past one more traffic light, he saw the sign for a branch of his bank. Pulling into the parking lot, he saw that the bank was still open, and experienced a sense of strange accomplishment. He watched as she pulled in behind him. He signaled with one hand that she should stay where she was, and she nodded once. In about 10 minutes, he carried out 2 envelopes of cash. They had the bulky softness of flesh, and handed them to her through her partly open driver's side window. She opened the window more, as though she were about to thank him, but he shook his head to stop her. "If I hear from you again, I'll track you down and kill you myself," he said calmly. "Whether your name is Tracy, or Lacey, or Shitty, or Pretty, get it? Because you will need more." She started her car and drove away. Now the shaking began. First his hands, then his arms, and then his thighs. He had stolen from Marilyn, and wasn't that different? It seemed to him that that was different from anything else he had done. He was no longer earning money, nor was she. It really shook him up. He had stolen money from his wife. He sat in his car until he felt he could drive. Only the faintest afterglow was in the sky now. It was a dangerous time, because it was essentially dark, not even dusk anymore. Quickly, quietly, night had descended. And yet it was not nighttime. There were hours before one could sleep. His pills at best gave him 5 hours of sleep. The bed and breakfast was a larger house than it appeared to be from the street. He parked in the lot behind it and walked back around. The air was crisp against his face, like the witch hazel aftershave he'd used many years ago. And he went up the front steps, which slightly creaked. And that sound slightly pleased him. His instinct told him that this was a good place to be when the real blow arrived. He could be safe here. It could allow a man like him. In fact, the woman who answered the door was as old as he was, perhaps older. A tiny, prim woman with good skin. Immediately he thought, she'll be afraid of me. But she did not seem to be. She looked him in the eye, asked if a room without a television would be all right. If he wanted to watch television, he could watch it here in the living room. The other guests seemed to have already turned in. At first he told her no, he did not need a television. But when he saw his room, he understood that he could not sit in there and wait. So he came back into the hall, and she said, "Of course," and gave him the remote, and said, "Do you mind if I join you once I'm done in the kitchen?" He said he wouldn't mind. "I don't care what we watch," she added. In a distant way, he understood that she had her own echoes of pain. At their age, he supposed, who did not? Then he supposed that many did not. It occurred to him often that many did not have echoes of pain from the silent noises he carried in his head. He sat on the couch and heard her in the kitchen. He crossed his arms and watched a British comedy, because British comedies were ridiculous, so removed from anything real. Safe, those British comedies. The accents, the clackety teacups. And so he waited. It would come. The wave upon wave of raw pain after a blow like this. Oh yes, it would come. Quietly, the proprietress slipped into the room. From the edge of his eye, he saw that she took the big chair in the corner. "Oh, perfect," she murmured. He assumed meaning the choice of show. He wanted to ask her, "If you made your name up and chose it to be Tracy, what do you think your real name would be?" And so it was coming closer. Yes, sirree, Bob. He knew what it was. He had been there before, and then it would be over. And yet, it was taking longer than he thought it would. You never get used to pain, no matter what anyone says about it. But now, for the first time, it occurred to him. Could it really be the first time this had occurred to him? That there was something far more frightening. People who no longer felt pain at all. He had seen it in other men. The blankness behind the eyes. The lack that then defined them. So Charlie, a tiny bit, sat up straighter, and he stared pretty hard at that television set. He waited, hope like a crocus bulb inside him now. He waited, and he hoped. He practically prayed. "Oh, sweet Jesus, let it come. Dear God, please, could you please let it come?" Mississippi Mary. "Tell your father I miss him," Mary said, dabbing at her eyes with the tissue her daughter handed her. "Can you tell him that, please? Tell him I'm sorry." Her daughter looked up at the ceiling, such high ceilings in these Italian apartments, and turned to look briefly toward the window through which the ocean could be seen, then looked back at her mother. Angelina could not stop thinking how old her mother seemed, and small, and weirdly brown. She said, "Mom, please stop this. Please stop it, Mom. It took my whole year's savings to fly over here, and I find you in this awful... I'm sorry, but it is. This squalid two-room flat with this guy, your husband? Oh, God. And he's almost my age, and we've just ignored that fact. What else could we do but ignore that fact? And now you're 80 years old, Mom."
78.
Mary had stopped weeping.
"And he's not your age at all. He's 62. Come on, honey."
Angelina said, "Okay, so you're 78. But you've had a stroke and a heart attack."
"Oh, now, please. That was years ago."
"And now you're telling me to tell Dad you miss him?"
"I do miss him, honey. I imagine there must be days he misses me, too."
Mary's elbow rested on the arm of the chair. Her hand waved the tissue listlessly.
"Mom, you don't get it, do you? Oh, my God, you just don't get it."
Angelina sat back on the sofa, brought both hands to her head, and pulled her fingers through her hair.
"Please don't yell, honey. Were you brought up to yell at people?"
Her mother tucked the tissue into her large yellow leather pocketbook.
"I never felt like I did get anything. No, there were lots of things I didn't get. I'll agree with you on that. Please don't yell at me, though, Angelina. Did I just say that?"
Mary's daughter, the youngest of five girls, and Mary's secret favorite, was named Angelina because Mary knew during her pregnancy that she was carrying a little angel. Mary sat up straight and looked at the girl, who had been a middle-aged woman for years. Angelina did not look back. From where she sat in the corner chair, Mary could see the sun hitting the steeple of the church, and she let her eyes rest on that.
"Daddy yelled all the time," Angelina said, looking down at the upholstery of the couch. "You can't yell at me for yelling and say I wasn't brought up that way when I was. I was brought up with quite a yeller. Daddy was a yeller."
"Old yeller." Mary put a hand to her chest.
"Honestly, what a sad movie that was. Why, we took you kids to see it, and I think Tammy didn't sleep for a month. Do you remember they took that poor dog out to the pasture and killed him?"
"They had to, Mom. He was rabid."
"A rabbit?"
"Rabid."
"Oh, Mommy, I don't want you to be making me sad like this."
Angelina closed her eyes briefly, bouncing her hand gently on the couch.
"Of course you don't," her mother agreed. "Did you really spend all your savings to get here? Didn't your father help you at all?" "Honey, I wasn't yelling at you for yelling. Let's go do something fun."
Angelina said, "Everything in a foreign country seems so hard. And the Italians seem proud of not speaking English. Did you think that when you first came here? That everything seemed so hard?"
Mary nodded.
"I did. But the person gets used to things. You know, for weeks, if Paolo wasn't with me, I didn't even try and get my coffee at that place on the corner. They thought I was his mother at first. And then they found out I was his wife, and I think they were sort of laughing at us. But Paolo taught me how to pay with my coins on the plate."
"Mom?"
"What, honey?"
"Oh, Mommy, it makes me sad, that's all.
not knowing how to put the right coins on a plate?
No, Mom. Thinking you were his mother.
Mary considered this.
Except, why would they think I was his mother? I'm American. He's Italian.
They probably didn't think that.
You're my mother,
Angelina burst out, and this caused Mary to almost weep again, because she had a searing glimpse then of all the damage she must have done. And she, Mary Mumford, had never in her life planned on doing or wanted to do any damage to anyone. They sat by the window in the cafe past the church. The cafe was built on rocks that looked out over the water. The late August sun sparkled crazily on everything. In 4 years, Mary had never stopped being banged on the head with the beauty of this village. But Mary was very anxious. Her eldest daughter, Tammy, had emailed her that Angelina was having trouble in her marriage, and Mary had thought she would ask Angelina about this as soon as they were alone. Yet she could not seem to do so. She would have to wait for Angelina to bring it up. Mary pointed to a large cruise ship on its way to Genoa, and Angelina nodded. The window they sat by was open, and the door was open. Mary ate her apricot cornetto, then put her hand on Angelina's arm. She started singing quietly, "You were always on my mind." But Angelina frowned and said, "Are you still wacky about Elvis?"
"I am."
Mary sat up straight, putting her hands in her lap. "Paolo downloaded all his songs for me onto my phone." Angelina opened her mouth, then closed it. From the corner of her eye, Mary noticed once again that age had touched her baby. Angelina's face had creases by her mouth and by her eyes that Mary had not remembered. Her hair, still pale brown and still worn below her shoulders, was thinner than Mary had thought it was. And the jeans she wore were so tight. Mary had noticed this right away.
"Look, honey," Mary said, waving a hand toward the sea. "I just love how things are lived outside more in Italy. This open door, the open window."
Angelina said, "I'm cold."
"Take this."
Mary handed her the scarf she always wore.
"Unfold it," she directed, "and it will open enough to wrap right around your skinny little shoulder bones."
Her youngest child did this.
"Tell me about your life," Mary said. "The tiniest stuff, if you want."
Angelina rummaged through her blue straw handbag and brought out her phone, which she placed on the table between them.
"Well, the twins and I went to a crafts fair, and you wouldn't believe what we got. Wait, I think I have a picture on my phone."
Mary pulled her chair closer and peered at the phone, and she was able to see the pretty pink sweater that one of the twins had bought for Tammy's birthday.
"Tell me more," Mary said.
Her desire seemed suddenly as large as the heavens.
Show me," cried her heart. "Show me all the pictures," she said.
"I have 632 pics," Angelina reported after squinting at her phone.
"Show me each one."
Mary beamed at her sweet youngest girl.
"No crying," Angelina warned. "Not a drop."
"One drop, and we stop."
"My goodness," Mary said, thinking, "who was it that raised this girl?"
The sun went behind a cloud as they walked back to the Casa Giotto. and this changed the light dramatically. The day seemed suddenly autumnal, yet the palm trees and brightly painted buildings were at odds with this, even for Mary,